Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews.
By students, for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Short Coat Podcast. I'm Dave Etler. Sister Helen Prejean is a well-known anti-death penalty advocate who has ministered to prisoners on death row. She began her prison ministry in 1981 by becoming pen pals with Patrick Sonnier, a convicted murderer of two teenagers who was sentenced to death by electrocution in Louisiana's Angola State Prison. Since then, she has witnessed five executions and founded the victims advocacy group Survive in New Orleans. She continues to counsel inmates on death row as well as the families of murder victims. Sister Prejean speaks out against the death penalty through lecturing, organizing, and writing, and she's the author of two books on the subject. Dead Man Walking, an eyewitness account of the death penalty in the United States, was an international bestseller, and it was developed into the 1996 motion picture for which Susan Sarandon won an Oscar for Best Actress. Her second book, The Death of Innocence, an eyewitness account of wrongful executions, tells the story of two men whom she accompanied to their executions. That book examines the evidence uncovered in those investigations, including evidence no jury ever heard, and sought to illuminate the flaws that can lead to the deaths of innocent people. Aaron Renfrew, Ethan Forsgren, Corbin Weaver, and Greg Youngtim brought her here to the Carver College of Medicine and started off the discussion with a simple question. Why should the death penalty be something medical students should think about and understand?
Well, it has been very interesting when you look at the history of the death penalty in the United States. It used to be public hanging, you know. And then we are moving supposedly toward more and more humane ways to kill people. So when we were doing the film, A Dead Man Walking, Tim Robbins was working on the screenplay. And he called me one day and he said, Helen, I know the first three people you've been with who were executed were killed by electrocution. But more and more states are turning to lethal injection. They're trying to make death, as it were, medicinal, and that we're just, quote, putting people to sleep. And I think in the film, we need to change it to lethal injection. And I agreed with him. So what we've seen is that more and more we're trying to get to a place in the with killing, state killing of human beings, that we're not really killing people. We're like putting them to sleep. But in the process itself, once you say that you're going to do IVs and you're going to inject drugs, it involves a medical profession. It involves, too, physicians in the process, but now they're getting more savvy, who declare the person dead after the execution happens. Mm-hmm. They put the stethoscope up to their heart. They look in their eyes, see if the pupils, you know, are fixed or not. And I'll never forget one doctor, he was on NPR, and I was amazed that he hadn't thought through the questions before he got on the radio program. And they said, well, doctor, we understand. He said, oh, I don't participate in the execution. I'm just there as the doctor, and my job is to declare the person dead and sign the death certificate. And so they said, well, doctor, so suppose whatever the method is, you go and you check and you put your stethoscope to the heart of the person. And, well, suppose the heart's still beating. What's your next step? And he goes, well, you know, I have to let them know person's still alive, which is a signal to the executioner, more juice or whatever. And they said, well, doctor, if you were in a hospital and a person's brought in and they're barely breathing, and what is the signal you give to the other hospital people? And he goes, oh, wait, I think I see where you're going with this, he said. Code blue, which means save life. This is the signal, not dead yet, do more juice. And he went, oh, yeah, I see what you mean. I was amazed that he got into that conversation and he didn't see where it was leading. So you have physicians at the level of somebody's got to declare death. Then you also have physicians involved at every step in the process of suggesting the drugs or assisting. They call them technicians, like in Louisiana. And they say, oh, we don't have doctors. We have these technicians. Mm-hmm. And some of them were so ill-prepared, like Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma, that botched execution. They were injecting stuff into the muscle. They didn't even know they weren't in a vein. So you really have these deaths that are taking place, you know, a protocol of death by the state, somehow with the physicians lurking in the background, but anonymous, to give them the assistance they need to help kill people.
We know that you have often accompanied these prisoners to the point of death. But, and from our perspective, too, we also realize that there are physicians even before that point of death who have been with that prisoner in the prison system or something like that. Have you ever, do you have any reflections on just physicians you've seen who are with that prisoner, either in the prison leading up to that point and then at that point, what relationships they have with prisoners?
I have never seen physicians in prison with prisoners. First of all, you know, the health care that you receive in prison is absolutely horrible, if not non-existent. And when you have some kind of medical situation in your life in a prison, you have to declare yourself an emergency to get help. Mm-hmm. And then they decide, if the big thing is called malingering. Prisoners are never trusted. They're not trusted about their own health. And so if you get written up for malingering, it means you go in the dungeon or you go in the hole because they've declared you were not an emergency at all. And you wait weeks. And I've never seen a physician. It takes some bizarre turns around the death penalty itself, though, when physicians or health people are involved. For example, Richard Glossop in Oklahoma recently. He's an innocent man. We were doing a lot to try to save his life, and we did. By getting the world in there to watch, so Oklahoma didn't dare kill him. And he was supposed to be killed at 3 in the afternoon. Well, he's brought to this holding cell, which is made completely of cement, 60 days ahead of time, where he's kept in relative isolation from his fellow human beings on death row. And the morning of the execution at 3 o'clock, they took him to be x-rayed. And so they bring him in. He's just in his shorts. He's very cold. And they x-ray his whole body. And, of course, they say nothing to you about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But, of course, I guess they want to show that the person's really healthy so that the prison doesn't get some kind of lawsuit, that it was a health problem that wasn't treated. Who knows? But he was x-rayed at 3 in the morning, and then he was brought back to his cell to wait, you know, for execution. Then you also have the bizarre thing of you have a guard stationed by a person who's going to be executed for 24 hours. I mean, so you go in shifts to watch them to make sure they don't try to commit suicide and deprive the state of taking their life. So in Oklahoma, again, you had this case of somebody on death row like 3 weeks before their execution, got a hold of some pills and OD'd and was found unconscious in his cell, taken to the hospital, revived, taken back, and then killed by the state 3 weeks later. So you get into bizarre stuff mm-hmm. here.
Yeah, it's so unusual how the relationship with that prison, with that patient, suddenly changes, and it's so sudden. It's one of, like you were saying, Ethan, it's one of accompaniment at first and a normal and an almost typical doctor-patient relationship. And then suddenly, you know, out of nowhere, suddenly it becomes the exact opposite, putting them to death.
It's right. Such but, a and you know, change. But where medical students may be involved directly with this is when prisoners are going to be brought right. into the hospital. One of our own sisters, her name was Ann Barker, was in med school, LSU med school, and she was working in the emergency room at Charity Hospital, and prisoners would routinely be brought in. Guards bring them in, mm-hmm. and when you travel out of the prison, you have a belt around your right. waist, and you have what's called the black box. It freezes your hands in a fixed position, very close to your stomach like this, and leg irons, and they're brought in, and she would always like battle with the guards because the guards, are they going to try to escape at mm-hmm. any moment? And so they're just really, really rigid about that. And she wants to be able to talk to the person. And she just found it so, so difficult.
Mm-hmm. So that UIHC, there's a prison not too far from here. And so our emergency department regularly gets prisoners coming in One of my first experiences, probably about 2 weeks after I started medical school, I was shadowing a physician in our emergency department, Dr. House. And we walked into one of the rooms, and there was a prisoner in there. His shoes were off, and we looked at his feet, and one of his toes was black as a consequence of diabetes mismanagement. And that was kind of my first look into prison healthcare, and something so simple as basic diabetic care is something that they don't get. But since then, I've also talked to physicians who are involved in correction medicine and very passionate about providing care, specifically in this institution, to women's prisons. And so I know that there are physicians out there that very much want to serve this population.
That's great.
And
they
so when
need
you
in there.
Right. And so when you get into that issue where you're looking at this as a vulnerable population, I want to serve them, I want to relieve suffering, and you get to death row where there are guards, as you said, misplacing IVs, injecting into muscle, and you know that this is happening, what is your responsibility as someone committed to relieving suffering at the end of life when so much suffering, additional suffering, is being placed on these people?
Well, you know, what working for justice means in any of this is, what is this system going on here and how has it been tolerated and allowed to happen? And the heart of the problem is we have a Supreme Court that has not demanded transparency of states doing the killing. They haven't demanded transparency of what drugs they're using. Mm-hmm. They haven't demanded transparency of how equipped are the people who are going to be carrying out this process. And they've been allowing them to get away with that. So that's where I think the heart of the problem is. Mm-hmm. The way you change anything, the way we change slavery, the way we change women getting to vote, is citizens like us are in there. We see things going wrong. We begin to write about it. We begin to speak about it. And we awaken the consciousness of the public about it. And we call for change. That's the long haul. But there are individual heroes in each of these stories where there's a compassionate doctor in there. There's like Barbara Aldave in Oregon, and I'm sure this is maybe 10, 15 years ago that this happened. The women's prison, the women who were giving birth were mm-hmm. shackled while they were giving birth because the prison was saying they might escape. Security is always their thing. And she had to take them to court, and it was a long battle. She had to battle, but finally she prevailed. So when you talk to people, the basic mentality toward prisoners is they've done bad things. We mm-hmm. need to be afraid of them. They just as soon get out and kill you as soon as looking at you. So there's part of that in the public
right.
perception that's fed by the media, bad, bad people that do bad things to you. And we have to protect ourselves against them. That's part of the general picture of that. That they don't deserve compassion because, hey, look what they did to their victim. Why should we be compassionate about them? And that happens in emergency rooms because it's an attitude toward prisoners as other, as a kind of monster, and they don't deserve any compassion on any level, even especially around health.
It seems to me that, you know, just as you were saying that right now, it seems to me that the priority is very apparent when you talk about the prison system, you know, insisting that pregnant women be shackled in labor and that death row inmates are revived in ERs just to be brought back to be killed. It's the priority is very clearly the justice system trying to enact its, quote, justice, rather than focusing on a ideal of humanity, you know, a different ideal of maybe reconciliation or something like that. You know, its clear goal is that end. Did we get to punish them the way we wanted to punish them?
Is it revenge?
Exactly. It feels almost more like the system trying to get revenge on these people instead of justice, instead of a restorative justice.
Yeah. Well, it's easy to slip into what you call revenge. Let's look at the mentality of, look at what you did to your victim. And that's mirrored, it was mirrored in people like Justice Scalia mm-hmm. when the hearing came up about what drugs you could use. And the whole thing is, when you actually looked, when we had the three drug cocktail, anesthetic, the first drug, mm-hmm. the second drug paralyzes the person completely.
Right.
They can't bat their eyes. They can't mm-hmm. cry out. Mm-hmm. The third drug is a real killer, which is potassium chloride.
Right.
So when during the hearing before the Supreme Court about what drugs could be used, it was a Kentucky case, and it came up, well, like, why that second drug? If the anesthetic's putting people under, the potassium chloride's killing them, why the second drug? And so at first, what the state people from Kentucky said, well, it's to preserve their dignity. We don't want them thrashing around mm-hmm. on the gurney when they're dying, because it's their dignity, their right to privacy. But then upon further discussion, it was, we want to protect the witnesses from seeing any kind of struggle when we're killing people. Mm-hmm. And so when they have had the botched execution, like with Clayton Lockett, whom they said they killed while trying to execute him, it went on and mm-hmm. on, and they couldn't find a vein, and the witnesses are watching, and then finally they close the curtains, and then Clayton Lockett died of a heart attack. But it's to preserve the witnesses. Look what a secret ritual this whole thing is anyway. It's behind prison walls. It's why I wrote the book, Dead Man Walking, to bring people close into what it means for us to say we're going to kill a human being who's done a terrible crime. So when you say revenge, it just means we're doing to them what they deserve to get because of what they did to their victim. And we're trying to clean it up. We're trying to make it look good. Mm-hmm. We're trying to make it look humane. But what they do not take into account, and we did sign the UN Convention Against Torture.
Right.
Mm-hmm. George Bush Sr. had made sure we signed onto it before we went into Persian Gulf War I, and clearly it defines torture as an extreme mental or physical assault against someone rendered defenseless. So everyone I've ever known on death row, everyone has the same nightmare. They're coming for me. It's my time. And they're dragging me out of my cell, and I'm yelling, no, no. And then I wake up, and I'm in my cell. It's not my time yet. People have imaginations and consciousness. Mm-hmm. So we anticipate what is going to happen to us. And again, I put it right in the laps of the Supreme Court that has not acknowledged that the killing of a conscious, imaginative human being with a date set at a future time is mental torture. What can be a greater torture than be told, we're going to take you out, we're going to kill you? And then Dobie Gillis Williams' first story in The Death of Innocence was brought in a death house three times before he was actually killed, mm. because it's a human process. And there are two red telephones in the killing chamber in Louisiana. One's to the courts, and then the other one is to the governor's office. And you can get a stay either way. So Dobie's brought in the first time, an hour and a half before the execution. He was being served his last meal. The Supreme Court had a legal question. Life is saved. He goes back for another month, comes back. Again, the same thing. Last minute delay for a week. And by the time we came to the third time, he said, I need it to be over with. I can't make my legs keep holding me up into this. But they cannot acknowledge mental torture. Mm-hmm. I was just at the law school and University of San Francisco last week, and I learned a new term. It's called motivated cognition. The way we know things and how we frame things has a lot to do with what our values are around it. So we don't call this torture. And immediately you flip to, look what they did to their victims.
Right.
So you had people like Justice Scalia saying things like, well, it seems to me after what they did to their victim, death by lethal injection is an enviable death, he says. And so look at the mentality behind that, and no wonder we are where we are, right?
It's amazing how the power of that label has so much meaning on, just like you're saying, on how we view them, on how they, once, you know, the judge hits their gavel that last time and they're officially deemed
right.
a guilty person, they're no longer a person. They're right. just that monster that they've been labeled.
Yeah. Right. It's especially troubling to me in the face of well, the whole range of people that have been exonerated since DNA evidence has started becoming a well-known thing. And then also in the face of some of the minimum sentencing laws and whatnot that we've had. I mean, I don't know if most people realize that United States into this century was giving the death penalty to juveniles.
We were the last country, along with Somalia,
that said
we shouldn't kill kids.
The company that we keep internationally by having the death penalty, and especially the death penalty for juveniles, is not a company that we generally want to be in.
We're one of the top five executors in the world, along with China and Iran and Yemen and, bad company.
I was just thinking, one of the, of course, arguments against the death penalty, besides the fact that you're killing a human being, is that the death penalty essentially makes killers of us all when the state executes someone in our name. And also what the death penalty does to people like the guards who have to enact the death penalty. And that I think that that logic, you know, can be further extrapolated to the doctors who are involved and what that does to the healthcare profession and the doctors involved who are called on to ensure the death of somebody when us as physicians are called on to do no harm and to preserve life at all costs.
Yeah,
and I'm kind of curious about your thoughts on the impact of the death penalty can
play. Well, you know, we are beginning to end the death penalty in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And part
mm-hmm.
of it has been the testimony and witness of people like guards and wardens who have had to participate in the killing process. One warden of Florida, Ron McAndrews, he said, I went into being the warden of this prison as an honorable profession. I was going to run a fair prison, a good prison, see what we could do to restore lives. But then he was involved in two executions. And wardens can't get away from, they are the first trigger. In Texas, the warden takes off his glasses. That's a signal to the executioner to begin injecting to kill the patient. In Louisiana, the warden nods his head. And Ron McAndrews gives talks publicly. And he says, I'm with a therapist. I'll be in therapy the rest of my life. I got involved, and there I am in the room, and I'm giving the signal to kill this person. And it's going to haunt me for the rest of my life. And he said, it's not an honorable profession at all to participate in the killing of a defenseless person. It was the religious argument I used to when I had a chance to dialogue with Pope John Paul from a religious point of view, from being a Christian point of view, is that in the moral teaching of the Catholic Church, that defense of society, the state has a right to take life, to defend society, was always the teaching. But then when you get to, well, we have a way to defend the lives of our citizens, and that's what prisons are for. And one of the things I said to him in the letter was, when I'm walking with a man to execution, he's shackled hand and foot, surrounded by six guards. And he says, Sister, please pray that God holds up my legs as I make this walk. And I said, does the Catholic Church only uphold the dignity of innocent life? Well, what about guilty life? And where's the dignity in rendering a person defenseless and taking them out and killing them? So you have, and I talk about a guard in Dead Man Walking. He was the supervisor of death row in Louisiana, and he did well in his job. He was fair. He was good. Then they moved him to the execution squad. And he called me in his office one day. And he said, just, I'm going to have to quit this job. He said, I know each of these guys. I know every one of them. And I know what crimes they did. And some of them did unbelievable crimes. But you get to know them, and the way he put it was, and you get to know the little boy inside of them. Mm-hmm. And he said, then they moved me on to the TAC team, as we call it in Louisiana, the tactical team, the one that's willing to use force to get people. And he said, I didn't even strap them on the gurney. He said, my job was just to go to their cell after they had been executed with a paper sack and collect their clothes and their toothbrush and their stuff to give to their family. And I bet, and come home afterwards, and I just get in my lazy boy chair, and I can't sleep, and I can't eat. My wife knows not to talk to me. He said, I can't do it anymore, and I'm going to quit. So their stories are coming out more and more, and how it's affected them to participate in the killing of their fellow human beings. And so you have both sides, of course. I've also been in the death house in Louisiana. Really, Celestine, he was about to be executed. He'd done an unspeakably terrible crime. He had killed this elderly couple in their apartment. His mother was there with him. It was the last hours before he was supposed to be brought to execution. And he got a stay of execution because there was a legal question. So I happened to be standing, and his mama, Teresa, was right there. And I was hugging her because she was saying, thank you, Jesus, you saved my boy, you saved my boy. And I looked over her shoulder into the eyes of a guard, and his eyes were like flint, like, you know, he should have been, you know what he did, he deserves to die. So it can affect the guards both ways. They psych themselves up for killing, and they're disappointed if it doesn't happen. So there's a lot of conflict all around in this among the guards themselves and people that have to work this close to state killing.
So one of the, in interviews with physicians who have been part of the execution process, one of the points that is often brought up is that we have a process for sentencing people, and it's a societal thing, and it's, we are upholding something that has been said by us, the whole society as a whole. And so I guess what my question is what is the role of medical providers there? Are we agents of society? Are we agents of the state? Are we agents of the patient? Or are we agents of ourselves? And I was wondering if you had some comments on that.
Yeah, I don't have too much of those agency conversations of who's an agent or what, but I know this, that to the extent that physicians participate in the process to kill human beings who've been rendered defenseless, they're accountable for that. Ethically, ethically, you're participating. It's the opposite of the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm. So to participate in any way, and the American Medical Association has come out with really strict guidelines.
Right.
Yeah. Of course, if you're keeping everything secret and you don't know who the people are, then you don't have to be accountable. But that's the accountability that any of, and they say that in the guidelines, to give your knowledge, your expertise, the help of the technicians to do it in any way. So to me, it's an ethical issue more than any other issue. And that comes to individuals participating. And, you know, you get on these career tracks, these life tracks, and sometimes you're brought into the prison system. I mean, some people pay back their debt by going to a prison and being part of the medical team there. And they might get involved in, there's an execution. It's interesting when you do write the death certificate and it asks for cause of death, guess what you have to write on the death certificate after you've executed somebody? Cause of death. What do you think? Take a chance.
Homicide.
I bet so. Homicide?
Yeah. It is homicide. It's the killing of a human being by another human being. So the truth is told on that death certificate. And so the participation in any kind of way of healthcare professionals who are there to promote life and help life.
I've noticed in reading articles and just learning about this issue that so many times when this question is brought up, the you know, state or the, you know, the prison warden or whoever is commenting on the situation always keeps the identity of the anesthetist or the doctor. It's always secret. It's always confidential because everybody involved knows that if that doctor was discovered to be helping with that process, they could very well lose their license and their life and their, you know,
that's right,
their
right
way of life. They wouldn't be a doctor anymore if they found out they were helping. And yet it's still something that's mandated by many of the states who have executions. It's
what's mandated
to have a physician
or an anesthetist there.
Yeah,
it has to, you know, so it's a state law for a physician to do something that is, you know,
and even where it's not a state law, even where it's not a state law, it's still, there's this disconnect between the state law AMA guidelines, medical board guidelines, and the prison procedures. Right, right. So even where it's not law in the state, a lot of times the prison procedures, which I found dug up by Human Rights Watch, have a medical professional involved, whether the state mandates it or not.
Yeah.
Well, and then, you know, when you read about Guantanamo and the torture and the role that psychologists played in that, you know, that's part of the medical profession, is for people who are psychologists or mental health doctors, if you will. And they get involved too. And so they design the torture, how long you can hang somebody from their thumbs or how long you can make them stand before doing permanent injury to an organ. So there you have, you know, the involvement as well of people who should be about healing and wholeness in our society, getting involved in terrible things. Just apart from death, I just want to say medical care in prisons is horrible. Mm-hmm. They just let people die. It's really, really bad because they accuse you of malingering and you die early. You know, mm-hmm. there are a lot of people with hepatitis C. It's untreated. There's just a lot of health conditions that go on in prisons.
And there's such advocacy challenges for physicians in that position because they are employees of the prison, employees of the state, and they're seeing this happen, but there's no avenue for advocacy, really.
No. Yeah, and I think as a critique to ourselves, a lot of times being a physician at a prison is really looked down upon within the profession.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not something that a lot of people aspire to do.
Right.
You know, even though it is in many ways a noble thing to care for these people who are marginalized and who are shut off from society, to me especially, that's a very noble thing. But to our profession, it's very looked down upon and kind of scoffed at.
I think a lot of that is because of what we've discussed, and a lot of times, whether you mean to or not, you become complicit in a lot of these human rights violations, right, just by being present. You're asked to own things that should never, a medical professional should never be involved in, like executions.
Right. But you know, at another level, because despised people in our society, the same person that I was talking about, Ann Barker, went to medical school, and so she was doing her residency at Charity Hospital. And it's people who are poor and who act badly. And I'll give you as an example. So she said, here's this man brought in. He had OD'd on drugs. He was homeless. He lived out on the streets. He had OD'd on drugs. And we spent hours to save his life and pumped out his stomach, helped him regain consciousness, brought him back to health. And 4 months later, he's back in that emergency room. It's 2:00 in the morning. You're dead tired. And here he is again. And you find yourself angry.
Mm-hmm.
You're tired. We cared enough about you to save your life. Here you are again. You don't care about your own life out on either. And so just the harshness of, you know, that can just be present there because you're so tired and you're so angry. That don't you care about your own life? And I think that mentality can seep into prisoners as well, because some people, and prisoners are not always fun and nice and polite to deal with. I mean, they got a lot of problems, and so it's not like a doctor, you know, patient relationship that's really nice. And they have to wait long hours, and then they're angry when they get to you, and you're angry when you get to them, and it's a tough, tough situation on both sides. But doctors, I imagine, would be respected in the same way public defenders who defend poor people who have done terrible crimes, the way you're looked upon by society. You're not invited to a lot of super-duper cocktail parties and looked upon with great admiration for what you do. You're defending that scum? Or are you going to be in prison to try to... Those people didn't care about their victims, and now you're giving them medical care and using taxpayers' money?
You know, I think it's interesting, especially, you know, given, you know, it's a common thing to think, oh, well, they've already done this. this crime, like they aren't worthy of whatever it is, you know, whatever you're giving them. And I think it's interesting to reframe that thought as, in the justice system, we're all given an opportunity to defend ourselves. So that person has a right to an attorney, and that person needs to be defended. And in the medical system, essentially, you know, we're given, it's not the duty of the medical system to, you know, purport justice. It's the duty of the medical system to provide healthcare. And so, you know, withdrawing healthcare from someone who's guilty of a crime enacted by society makes absolutely no logical sense, because they've been given a punishment, and the punishment is not being, should not be enacted by the healthcare system.
But, you know, it's just to just say how human physicians are. Mm-hmm. We're all human beings. And when we get tired, and when we're in things where we're dealing with people that are very, shall we say, unsavory or hard to deal with, whether it's in an emergency room or whether it's in a prison, we're not always at our best. We need to cut ourselves some slack, not to take away from the values we need to hold ourselves to. But human, you know, doctors are human beings. And I think in the training, you just get so tired. I knew one who was in residency. He was so tired that when he'd have to ride the elevator at Charity Hospital in New Orleans from one floor to the next, he'd get in the corner to have a teeny tiny nap, like 5-second nap in the corner of the elevator because he's so blue and tired. And boy, when we're tired, I mean, you know, it's just, and also people have kind of have an exalted sense of doctors. While you're a doctor, they have no idea the drudgery, the everydayness, the all of the stuff that doctors go through. I have great respect for doctors because I think you go through a lot in terms of, it's not an exalted life at all. And so anyway, hats off to doctors that care about human rights and people as people, no matter who they are, and get a good night's sleep and have a whole life and have good relationships and eat good food and sometimes drink beer and play cards or see good movies or whatever. I have a garden, but you got to be whole to be able to be a good doctor, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It takes a lot of energy to choose your allegiances wisely, I think. We have all these different structures that we can swear ourselves to, and at some point with every patient and every moment you have to make that choice, and you want to have the energy to do it.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so one more question for you. So do you think physician refusal to participate in executions has the potential to change the current situation around the death penalty?
It's certainly helping it. Resistance to things that are wrong is just the basic. You know, Gandhi said that whenever we do something in a society, it's always presented to us as a good or a necessary thing. And so the first rule when we get involved in something and we see that it's exactly the opposite of what we learned as a health professional, that we have to expose it and name it for what it is, that it's not a good, it's an evil, and we have to actively resist it. So we don't participate in it, we resist. And then we bring attention to it as best we can so that nobody will be engaged in it who's in the health profession. And we have to support each other in doing that to be able to do the right thing. Be whole yourself and take care of yourself, because you're in a real giving profession, and it's exacting. And year after year, and with your families and your own relationships, to cultivate them like a garden, to give you time to have a balanced life. It's going to be tough, really. You're on call in relationships with primary partners. Intimate relationships can break apart if you get sucked into the work. And I'm not sure completely of the profile of this, but I remember going to one of the graduations, and they gave the profile of people that go into the medical profession. Mm-hmm. You tend to be, you know, OCD, you're really detailed oriented. I mean, you know, you're really in there in terms of an A-type personality to go get stuff done. And when you come up against your limits, even like the mortality of your patients, and you can't do anything to help them further, you know, it's welcome to the human race in that. And just know that we all come up against it. And I have a special love for physicians because my close friend, Ann Barker, she was a Catholic nun and she went to medical school when she was in her 30s and served people and served the poor and reopened a clinic in New Orleans that had been closed to poor people. But you can only do that for so long when, you know, you have to look at the cost to yourself and what is happening to you to stay in close touch with that. And you need loved ones who know you to help you be in touch with that as well so that you can stay whole and healthy.
Thank you very much. I think that's great advice.
Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Look, it's a joy. This is a great conversation.
Thanks so much for hanging out with us today. If you like what you hear, go to iTunes, whether you use iTunes or not, and give us a review. The reviews there help us grow the show, and they make us feel pretty good. As always, we're listening all over the place. Send us an email at theshortcoats@gmail.com, hit us up on Facebook or Twitter, or leave a comment we can play on the air at 347-746-7828. The show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis, and our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox, and our closing music is by Agrafox. Talk to you in 1 week.